This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
The NFL is great for many things, but most of all, because of some of the characters and the great players that have played the game. We go into the 17th part of our New York Giants 100 celebration, talking about the legend of Hap Moran, with a lot of help from some experts out there. We'll have more on Hap and his history in the NFL coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to this New York Giants 100th anniversary celebration. And we are in part number 17 of the segments of talking about some of the great events and players and people and games that the New York Giants have had over their first 100 seasons. Now, we have a special player today. One that's played a little bit in some other time periods and some other teams in the NFL, but nonetheless, one of the great Giants legends. We're going to tell his complete story with a little bit of help from some of our friends, including this man's son, Mike Moran. Of course, we're talking about Hap Moran. Now, Hap was born on July 31st, 1901 in Belle Plaine, Iowa, as Francis Dale Moran was his name. And he wasn't just a football player. He was a chameleon, adeptly switching positions and leagues while leaving an indelible mark in the gridiron. And though his name might not be prominent as others, his 12 seasons in the NFL from 1924 to 1933 was filled with versatility, leadership, and record-breaking feats. To commemorate his status, we know that in 2019, the legendary player was selected as the NFL's 100th anniversary celebration as the 22nd best ever pre-World War II halfback. Quite a testament to him. And as we said, he had a couple records that stood a long test of time. But one question we have is, how did he get the name as Francis Dale Moran to be called Hap? Well, his son Mike filled us in a 2021 interview we did with this.
There was a cartoon character named Happy Hooligan. And that is my understanding of where he got the nickname. And I think it might have had to do something with being sent to get a bucket of beer. I'm not sure about that part. but there was a Happy Hooligan. And so my grandmother would really, his middle name was Dale, which I don't even know how he spelled it. I mean, I spelled it more than one way, D-A-Y-L-E or D-A-L-E. She called him Dale or Happy. And occasionally in the programs, he's listed as Happy, not Hap. But Hap was what he used as an adult, anyway, that I know of. I never heard anybody call him Frank.
So where did Hap get his football prowess? You know, where did he play ball? Maybe talk about his college game.
I think where it started was really was on the railroad, because in the summers in high school, he would he worked as a railroad kind of track man, and they would get on these railroad cars and they would go out and repair track, and he would be swinging these 16-pound sledgehammers, you know, for weeks in the summer. And then when he went to high, he went to high school in Boone, Iowa, which is a big railroading town. And I have pictures of him playing football there, but really basketball was his sport. He was an All-American basketball player. In those days, it was considered, I don't know if it was illegal, but it was considered wrong for college coaches to go visit high schools and recruit. So Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was the famous Yale, you know, player and coach, but he was hired by the University of Chicago to build up a football. There's a great book about this called Staggs University, about the interaction between money, football, alumni. I mean, it goes way back. This is not a new issue. So what he did was he set up these interscholastic tournaments at the University of Chicago so that the best athletes in throughout the Midwest, I don't know how many Eastern schools came to him, and he could see them. And I have some of the track and field and basketball programs from those tournaments, and you see a lot of future great football players in there doing in those sports because there was no football tournaments. So Stagg picked my father as an All-American basketball player, and I think football was kind of secondary. And then he went to Grinnell College for a year, and I think he played on the freshman football and basketball teams, but then he was recruited by Carnegie Tech. And my brother went to Carnegie, which is now Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went to a football game there, and the crowd was less than my daughter's field hockey team got in high school. I mean, football was nothing at Carnegie in the 60s. But in the 20s, I mean, their schedule, they played Notre Dame regularly. They were a real powerhouse of football. So he played for them in 1922. And I think it's in the article that I'm sure you read it, but when they played Notre Dame, the Notre Dame-Carnegie game of 1922 was the first time the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame were ever on the field together. And that was, and so my father was the halfback for Carnegie against, the Four Horsemen. And Buddy got hurt. He got injured, and they went back to Grinnell, and he had to take a year off, and then he played for 2 years at Grinnell before going into the NFL.
So thus he goes into the professional level.
That his football coach at Grinnell wrote to the coach of the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, recommending him as a player. But I don't know the mechanism of that. I mean, he had some big runs in college. He got listed in the NCAA guide as like they have this thing of great runs from 1869 to 1926. And he's like on the first, maybe he's number 12. I don't know. He had some big run backs that always got, the stories got retold in every biography or, a little blurb they'd write about him.
Right.
And so I got a chance with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, which was the Philadelphia franchise before the Eagles.
When Hap broke into the league in 1926 with the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, the sports writers raved. One said, quote, "A player by the name of Moran, the star of the entire game, was unstoppable. Through the line, around the ends, averting opposing players and making the longest runs of the game. He seemed like he was right at home and was different from what went before. Like a star let down from the planet Mars with plays that poor fish on Earth knew nothing about. We are certainly pleased to tell our many readers of the wonderful addition of this player has made to the team and the spirit he put into the rest of the players," end quote.
The Yellow Jackets, it was really an athletic club. Athletic Association, and they had a golf course, and so they were in a bowling alley, I believe, or all I know is that my father worked, they also provided work for him at the golf course and at the bowling alley, and I would assume, I don't know about where they lived in Frankfurt, in Philly, but when he went to Pottsville, they all stayed in a hotel. There was the Necco Allen Hotel in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and that was where the players lived.
Well, what a tremendous year to go to the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets in 1926, because they had a pretty good season that year.
You know, and I think I'm not sure if it was 25 or 26 that they brought Guy Chamberlain as their coach. It might have been the year before. But, I mean, a lot of people never heard of Guy Chamberlain, but Guy Chamberlain was like the, you know, the Bill Belichick of the 20s. He was, he had been on the original Decatur Staleys with Hallis before it was the Bears. He was the coach of the Canton team. He won in the first 10 years of the NFL, I think he won five of the championships or was involved with five championship teams. So Chamberlain, he pulled it all together in 26 and they won the NFL title that year. But the NFL title back then was determined by your winning percentage. They had no championship playoff game. You know, I don't know. I've never seen, I have his contract. That's one thing I do have, his contract from that year. But I don't have any correspondence. I don't know how it came to be that he ended up in Pottsville. It was the only thing my father told me about Pottsville was that the field was like the basis of the field was all this slag coal because Pottsville was, you know, the anthracite district. It was the anthracite league. It was a tough league. It got out of the anthracite league and got into the NFL. And he said, if you cut yourself on that field, you had to like pour iodine over. It was like bacterially infected. And the other story he told, and I'm not sure if it was from that year or later, but just about those coal mining towns and the intense rivalries that existed was he got hired to play for some local coal mining town, you know, maybe Shenandoah, Gilberton. I don't know. I don't know the name. He was a ringer. He was brought in as a ringer. And he got there and like half the players on both teams were NFL players. They all knew each other. They'd all been brought in because there was such heavy betting on these games. And he said they played to a tie. And like they'd never even got their clothes back. They had to like get on directly from the field onto the train. People were going to, you know, strangle them because nobody made any money. They didn't lose any money, but nobody made any money. So that was a pretty tough team and a tough league. And I don't know, you know, they had a terrible year. They didn't do well. And they had four future Hall of Famers on that team. They had, let's see if I remember. Well, John Blood McNally was on it.
Right.
Walter Kiesling was on it. Peter Fats Henry, Pete Henry was on it. Maybe those were the only three. I don't remember now if there was a fourth or not. It seemed to me there was. Yeah, they did not have a good year. Again, I think it was management and coaching because after that season, the franchise moved to Boston for 1 year and then folded.
Pat Moran shared the Pottsville Maroons backfield with the legendary Johnny Blood McNally, a brutal tackle by the New York Giants lineman, Steve Owen, who ironically knocked himself out in the process, caught the Giants' attention, and Tim Mara promptly signed Moran for their final game of the season, a move that would see him become a key Giant for the next 5 years.
So at the end of that season, the Pottsville ended their season in 1928 before the Giants. And the Giants had this Yale All-American on their team named Bruce Caldwell. And Bruce Caldwell was a great runner, you know, really good player, but he wouldn't block for anybody. And at one point, the other Giants just stopped blocking for him, and he was just getting clobbered. And, you know, he'd been a marquee player at an Ivy League school, and the Giants released him right before the end of the season, and they brought my father in to take his place. And my father was a good blocker. I know he was not a prima donna. So I got some I got a great picture of him blocking for Friedman. It's just classic. So they brought my father in for the last game, and it was against Red Granger's New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium. And my father scored the touchdown for the Giants that day. And that's how he got to New York.
Here's an excerpt from the New York Daily Times, October 16th, 1933. Quote, in the third period, Hap Moran, one-time Carnegie Tech backfield flash, brought about the Giants' second touchdown by running nearly the entire length of the field. Admirable interference and Moran's shifty running kept him on his feet as he passed midfield and ran parallel to the sideline. Two interferers held pace with him until he crossed the 10-yard line. Then left end Dilwig overtook him and laid him low with a flying tackle, 1 yard from the Packers' goal line. End quote. On HapMoran.com, 1931 was the Giants' scoring leader and named as the All-Pro halfback. In 1933, he set another NFL record with 114 receiving yards in a single game against the Philadelphia Eagles. The Daily News of New York, October 16, 1933, had this to say. A few minutes after the game started, Ripper Roberts of the Philadelphia 11 attempted to throw a pass to one of his companions. The pass was intercepted by Mel Hine of the Giants, and Ken Strong gained 2 yards. The next Giant maneuver was a pass Harry Newman to Hap Moran. Hap fixed the ball against his bosom and sprinted 70 yards for the New York touchdown. An unexpected pass, Newman to Moran, accounted for the extra point, and presently the Eagle punt was blocked by Glenn Campbell on the Philadelphia 7-yard line. End quote.
Well, my dad retired from the NFL in 1933, and of course they had no benefits or pension plan then, but he did get a lifetime pass to any NFL football game, excluding championships, and so as a kid, I grew up in Queens, New York, about 40 minutes on the train from the Polo Grounds. So we would hop on the train and go to the Polo Grounds, and my dad would show the pass. We'd walk through the turnstile, and we'd go sit in the press box, and we watched the game. That he felt that he still knew some of the press guys. So, but I have to admit, as a kid, I wasn't paying much attention. I was looking for the next hot dog or the peanuts or something, you know. But it was a little intimidating because it was all these guys in their fedoras and their dark overcoats, you know, and their typewriters or whatever. And it's kind of a fond memory. And then later when the Giants went to Yankee Stadium, we could go in there and actually, I had met some of the players because on Election Day, which was a holiday in New York City, a couple of times, my dad took me up to practices. And we sat around and we watched them practice. Now we went into the clubhouse. And the thing I remember is shaking hands with these guys and coming away like numb up to my elbow. But I got to meet some of them and I became like there was the era of Connerly, and but my favorite was Ray Witeka, the center. So always had a soft spot for him. I didn't know, you know, much about the football history at that time, and that really didn't come into play till after my father died.
Hap Moran finished his NFL journey with 13 rushing touchdowns, 9 pass receptions for score, and 22 extra points kicked and 4 field goals. He's remembered as a versatile player with an exceptional running and receiving skills and held 2 NFL records that we just discussed for decades, showing his dominance. In 1994, Hap Moran passed away at the age of 93 and was long remembered. In 1991, at the age of 91, his 91-yard pass play, the longest in Giants history at the time, was remembered by the Giants in a special tribute on Giants television. You can find that at hapmoran.org. And we thank Mike Moran and others for contributing to this great legacy of this man, Hap Moran, and Larry Schmidt for all the great images that you got to see along the way, as well as Mike Moran himself for supplying much of the information and the photos as well. We thank these gentlemen and thank you for helping in the preservation of football history with this New York Giants 100 celebration of the great player, Pat Moran. Till next time, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network, and we're able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com.
You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day.
Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.